Eric Fair. He is a freelance writer these days, living in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. But between 1995 and 2000, he served in the Army. And then later, in 2004 and 2005, he worked for the Department of Defense in Iraq.
My time in Iraq was spent interrogating Iraqi prisoners. I did terrible things to these prisoners. At the time, we were calling these terrible things enhanced interrogation techniques, but we now know them to be torture. In war, torture feels reasonable. At home in Bethlehem, torture feels unforgivable. I'm often asked what can be done to best address the issues facing returning veterans. It's impossible to know if there's a good answer, but the foundation of any solution will start with listening. Listen to the stories they come home with.
And so we gather this morning as a community of faith to listen. To listen to stories told by veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan about their injuries. No, not the injuries that other people can see, but invisible injuries, injuries to their soul, moral injuries. These stories, Eric continues, if you are willing to listen to these stories, it will confuse your sense of morality. But if you are committed to healing the veterans who have fought in your stead, you'll need to learn to deal with moral injury. And rest assured, this is going to hurt.
We all have a conscience. We all have, you know, a sense between that tells us between right and wrong. When I joined the military, I was 19. And I was like, okay, so if we end up going to war, it's going to be for a good cause, you know. If we end up going to war, it's going to be to bring freedom to other lands. And we started gearing up to go to Iraq. And it was a war that I opposed politically, but not very personally. I went to Iraq thinking that I could push my principles aside and then get the war over with, put it behind me, move on. But nothing ever prepares you for the reality of war. When people ask me if I killed anybody, there's a lot of confusion because you see, war is not as clear-cut as they portray it in the movies. There was this one time we're positioned on this rooftop. It was like a political protest that turned violent. Everyone is quiet. And this young man emerges. And he's got something in his hand. And I know that it's a grenade. And, but I also know that he can't do anything to us because he's too far. Everything that I'm describing to you, I'm looking through the rear aperture of my M16 sight. So, it's a very, very, very intense moment. And I don't remember squeezing the trigger, and I don't remember seeing him go down. All I remember is that we shot at him, and that the next image that I have is, you know, two men came from the crowd and grabbed him by the shoulders and pulled him through a puddle of blood. And then I remember that after that mission was over, you know, before we moved on to our next mission, you know, I went into a dark room by myself and I pulled out my magazine and I counted the bullets and I realized that I had fired 11 bullets at him. And and it changes you.
Camilo Meja, forever changed. Kevin Powers was born and raised in Richmond, Virginia. He served in the U.S. Army in Iraq in 2004 and 2005 as a machine gunner. Today, he is a poet.
Letter composed during a lull in the fighting. I tell her I love her, like not killing, or 10 minutes of sleep beneath the low rooftop wall on which my rifle rests. I tell her in a letter that will stink when she opens it of bolt oil and burn powder and the things it says. I tell her how Private Bartle says offhand that war is just us making little pieces of metal pass through each other.
An excerpt from a book entitled Redeployment, written by Phil Clay, a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps who served in Iraq's Anbar Province during the surge.
We shot dogs, not by accident. We did it on purpose, and we called it Operation Scooby. I'm a dog person, so I thought about that a lot. First time was instinct. I hear O'Leary go, Jesus, and there's a skinny brown dog lapping up blood the same way he'd lap up water from a bowl. It wasn't American blood, but still, there's that dog lapping it up. And that's the last straw, I guess, and then it's open season on dogs. At the time, you don't think about it. You're thinking about who's in that house, what's he armed with, how's he going to kill you, your buddies. The thinking comes later.
We, the people of the United States of America, spent 14 years at war. Nearly 7,000 people died in the wars, troops died in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. 2.5 million men and women came home. Most of them are doing fairly well. Although half of them say that they feel disconnected somehow from civilian life, and one out of every two vets personally knows someone who has attempted or committed suicide. Others have returned broken in mind and body and in spirit. It is the duty of the rest of us to understand what broken really means. Since the beginning of human history, there has been war. And since the beginning of war, there have been people trying to make meaning and make sense out of what they have experienced. They use words like shell shock, battle fatigue, combat stress reaction, and post-traumatic stress disorder. But in the last few decades, experts have found that PTSD does not adequately describe the symptoms that are reported by returning combat veterans. The term moral injury actually better captures this condition. Moral injury refers to emotional, psychological damage incurred when a soldier has to do things that violate his or her sense of right and wrong. Moral injury can happen while perpetrating an act, and also while failing to prevent an act, bearing witness to some activity, or learning about acts that transgress deeply held moral beliefs and expectations. It has been described as a bruise upon the soul. Rita Brock, co-author of the book Soul Repair, says that part of the problem these days is the kind of war that we wage today. The kind of wars that soldiers must fight today is different than ever before. She says, when you throw people into war where there's no army, no organized military, and they're only fighting civilians, then moral ambiguities become quite fierce and horrible. You have soldiers then having to kill children, kill pregnant women, kill dogs. It becomes a terrible, moralizing, compromising situation for even people who feel good about being there, people who want to be there, people who feel good about serving their country. As Camilo said in his video, no one goes into the military because they want to kill. They all have a sense of conscience. They all have a sense of right and wrong. They all have a sense of themselves as good, honorable people. And we all have that capacity, don't we? That capacity for seeing others as beings just like ourselves, as beings who should be treated the way we would like to be treated. You can call it Holy Spirit or spark of the divine or product of evolution. There is in each one of us a moral force. A moral force. But our troops sometimes find themselves in morally confusing situations where there are no good options, and they have to act quickly and decisively, sometimes counter to their deepest conscience and their most essential self. That's what happened to Camilo. That hand grenade wasn't going to reach any soldiers, and yet it was going to kill somebody. He had to act quickly. Some veterans are afflicted with PTSD, some with moral injury, some with both. About 20 years ago, Dr. John Shea was the first person to put a label on this condition, moral injury. He explains the fundamental difference between PTSD and moral injury by using the analogy of a shrapnel wound. He says, whether it breaks bone or not, that wound is uncomplicated. It's primary, this injury. That injury doesn't kill the soldier. What kills him are the complications, the infection, the hemorrhage. And so he says post-traumatic stress disorder is the primary injury, the uncomplicated injury. But moral injury is the infection. It's the hemorrhage. That's because self-harming behaviors such as alcoholism and suicide are most closely associated with moral injury than with PTSD. This next story is told by Ashley Gilbertson about a young man named Noah.
Noah Pierce grew up in Sparta, Minnesota. When Noah went missing in July 2007, after a harrowing year adjusting to home following two tours in Iraq, police ordered a countywide search. His friend Ryan Nelson thought he might know where to look. When he pulled up to the spot, he immediately recognized Noah's truck. Inside, Ryan found his friend slumped over the bench seat, his head blown apart, a gun in his right hand. Half a bottle of Jack Daniel's special blend lay on the passenger seat, and beer cans were strewn about. On the dash lay his photo IDs. He had stabbed each photo through the face. And on the floorboard was the scrawled, rambling suicide note. It was his final attempt to explain the horrors he had seen and committed. He said in his suicide note it was impotence, a common side effect of post-traumatic stress disorder. But it could have been the memory of the Iraqi child he crushed under his Bradley. It must have been a dog, he told his commanders. It could have been the unarmed man he shot point blank in the forehead during a house-to-house raid, or the friend he tried madly to gather into a plastic bag after he had been blown to bits by a roadside bomb. Or, as the fragments of Noah's poetry might lead you to believe, it could have been the doctor he killed at a checkpoint. Noah Pierce was 23 years old.
Veterans make up just 7% of the U.S. population, but veterans represent 20% of all suicides. Every day, we lose 22 vets to suicide. Every single day. The emotional wounds of war can be just as deadly as the physical wounds of combat. Many experts now believe that moral injury has played a significant role in the rapid rise of military suicides since 2003. Surveys of Marines and soldiers indicate that many of them feel morally conflicted about the things that they've seen and the things that they have done. So Eric Fair, that man from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, who said torture feels unforgivable, he also tells another story about how he feels when strangers approach him and say, "Thank you for your service." Eric says that he has had to come to terms with what it means to be thanked for his service.
We appreciate the sentiment, but the gratitude is impotent in helping us to process the consequences of our actions overseas. Words like necessary, just, and honorable don't always describe what we feel, let alone what we've done. No matter how debased our enemy may have been, the act of war violated our moral codes.
I've heard other voices more cynical than his. Some say that the thanks sometimes comes off as shallow and disconnected from the people because they have no clue what soldiers really did over there. And these sentiments come often from people who would never voluntarily go to war themselves and would never allow their children to go either. In the novel Billy Lean's Long Halftime Walk, Billy and his fellow Bravo Squad soldiers are fresh from the Iraqi battlefield, and they are honored in a day-long celebration at Texas Stadium. And the soldiers dread this. The soldiers express dread over the people rushing to offer them thanks, pregnant with obligation and bloodlust, and their voices throbbing like lovers. Sometimes the gratitude expressed towards soldiers for their service is kind of a symbol of the ease by which we send a volunteer army to wage war at great distances. The Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Pryor saw combat in Iraq, and he now writes extensively about moral injury. He is particularly concerned about moral injury as it relates to the growing ease of waging war at great distances. He predicts that one effect of the rise of remote control warfare will be that the incidence of moral injury will just keep going up. Remote control warriors don't have to suffer the physical duress of combat. They don't have to see their friends being shot and killed. And this means they are in large part immune to post-traumatic stress disorder, but they are not immune at all to moral injury. Do you remember a few years ago when one of our drones attacked a convoy of trucks carrying people to a wedding? That drone killed dozens of people and injured many others. Unlike traditional deployments, airmen go home every day after carrying out drone attacks. What must that be like? Imagine the emotional adjustment that you have to make every single day as you transition from warfare to domestic life. So someone in the earlier service said that he knows one of these drone pilots, and he will, in the morning, strike, kill 16 people remotely, and then go down the street and have lunch with his wife at Applebee's. These stories, if you are willing to listen, will confuse your sense of morality. But if you are committed to healing the veterans who have fought in your stead, you will need to learn how to deal with moral injury. And I assure you, it is going to hurt. Most of the 2.5 million soldiers, airmen, Marines, and sailors came home without injury, either to body or soul. Most have been able to come home, all the way home, find work, build families, and integrate their wartime self with their civilian self. But for hundreds of thousands of others, adjusting to life back home means having to deal with shame and guilt, despair, and a deep sense of alienation from the rest of society. One soldier said, "We discovered in our communal struggle the shared sense of meaning and purpose and cause. War fills our spiritual void. I do not miss war, but I miss what it brought." I've heard lots and lots of vets talk about coming home and missing the sense of camaraderie and true community, true connectedness with brothers and sisters, relying on the interdependence. And then they come out into a world full of Kim Kardashians, this overly materialistic, deeply disconnected society. The civilian world seems frivolous. It seems dull. There's nothing at stake out here. It seems mean and senseless. This sense of separation from society is the most troubling aspect of moral injury. And it is also something that religions know a great deal about. Our purpose as a religious community is to serve those who feel alienated, isn't it? It is our role in the community to be with those who struggle and stumble, those who feel most out of place in the world. That is our role in society. Dr. Shea points out the fact that nearly every culture, except for ours, has created purification rituals for soldiers returning from war, and those purification rituals require the participation of every single member in the community. We need rituals, he says. We need liturgies, we need stories and song and poetry and art, all of which allow the community to come alongside the soldier and confess a truth. what you did was done in our name. What you did was done at our request. We allowed this to happen. We cannot bear your physical wounds or your psychological scars, but we can bear the moral responsibility with you. Your transgressions in war, they are our transgressions too. We confess this and we seek forgiveness together. We are all responsible. We are all responsible to care for the wounded souls that come home from war. Let us do all we can to abolish war. And then in the meantime, let us take care of those who serve with honor and dignity and courage. Amen.